You were recommended to help run the last leg of the relay that began with Adam and Eve because your premortal spiritual valor indicated you would have the courage and the determination to face the world at its worst, to do combat with the evil one during his heyday, and in spite of it all, to be fearless in building the kingdom of God. You simply must understand this, because you were born to lead.
It's time for another episode of the Leading LDS Podcast. I welcome you back. I am excited you keep coming back. I hope the information here is helpful. In this episode, I have the opportunity to interview Brother Brad Wilcox. Brad Wilcox is actually a professor at BYU in the teacher education department, and he also participates in, especially for youth programs, Campus Education Week. He served a mission in Chile, and later returned to Chile to preside over the Chile-Santiago East Mission from 2003 to 2006. And he just was released this past the conference of April 2014. He was released from the Sunday School General Board. And in this interview, we talk about various leadership positions he's had, namely bishop, mission president, and also as a member of the Sunday School General Board. And I learned a lot of things about some of those callings I didn't know before. He's also helped people understand and discover the doctrine of the grace of Jesus Christ, which is truly the core doctrine of the gospel. And we talk about how leaders, especially bishops, might use that doctrine effectively to help people through addictions and temptation. Also, he was so kind to offer three of his books as a giveaway, and I'll give more details at the end of the interview. So here is my interview with Brother Brad Wilcox. Brother Wilcox, how are you?
I'm doing great. And Kurt, you just go ahead and call me Brad. You don't have to be formal on this podcast. You just call me Brad.
All right. And we're just going to have some fun today and get your perspective of leadership and also grace. And that's really what I want to maybe start at, maybe learning a little bit about you personally. And then before we dive into the deep questions that'll really get us sweating here. So,
wonderful.
So tell us about kind of your upbringing. What, how was your faith developed throughout your life in relation to your being raised in the church and different experience you've had growing up?
Well, thank you. You know, it's interesting because just because we all grow up in the church, it doesn't necessarily mean that we all grow up in a perfect environment or with a perfect testimony. Every one of us has a journey of faith, and whether that journey begins with parents who are strong and active, or whether it begins with parents who are good people but not active in the church, kind of like President Monson's family.
Yeah.
Or if your journey includes a conversion later in life to the church, I think that all of us have to get to a point where we come to know Christ and we come to know His truth and we come to know His grace, His power in our lives. And that's kind of what happened to me. I grew up in a family with four boys, no sisters. My dad always said there's no such thing as women's work because we didn't have any women around to do the work. And so he said, we've got work. There's no women's work. There's no men's work. And so in our family, we all just grew up doing all the chores. And my parents were very bright and very wise in helping us understand and learn the value of work. I grew up in Ethiopia, Africa. My dad was over there setting up a teacher college to help train teachers and improve education in Ethiopia. And so I didn't know much about what he was doing at the time. I was just a little kid. But all my earliest childhood memories are of Africa. And I think because of that, I did come away with a perspective on things that might be a little different than a kid growing up in Utah or in the United States. I grew up with a real focus on the importance of literacy and education. Most little kids don't value school, but I did. And I didn't just value it because my mom and dad were educators. I valued it because I saw a world that didn't have it. And I saw how much people wanted it. And so I think I always had a love of learning and a love of school and a love of reading that maybe other kids didn't have. And that kind of transferred also into something else I learned in Africa, and that is the value of the church. We didn't have any formal church organization. We had a small branch that met in people's houses, and these were all expats. They were all people from the United States who were over there working, who were LDS. And so I didn't grow up going to a chapel, per se, or having a ward. And I think it focused me very early, not just on the social aspects of the church, but on the actual core of the gospel, which was the doctrine and our connection with God in heaven. And I think I had that at a very early age because of this experience in Africa. But then we moved back to the United States. I jumped all the little Mormon hoops and enjoyed going to Mutual and enjoyed seminary and went on my mission. And I didn't leave on my mission without a testimony, but I can certainly say that it was on my mission to Chile that my testimony deepened and really became my testimony. So I'll always be grateful for that mission, the impact of a good mission president at a turning point in my life.
Wow, that's fantastic. And since then, you've had, I'm sure, on the mission, you had various opportunities for leadership callings. But even after your mission, you've had a chance to serve as a bishop. You went back to Chile and served as a mission president. You've served in a stake presidency. And I believe currently you're on the Sunday School General Board. Is that accurate?
Yeah, just recently released. When they called the new presidency, former board was released. And the new board will be called probably here within the next few months.
Oh, okay. And maybe that leads into a question. I'll come back to some of your other callings. But a lot of people that we kind of just hear these words of General Board, I believe there's a Relief Society General Board, and we hear them in conferences, sustaining has come. Maybe can you describe kind of the dynamic of that calling, what it is, how it works, and what's required of you of being on the board?
That's a good question, because honestly, before I was called to the board, I really didn't know what it was either. But each of the auxiliaries, primary, Sunday school, young men, young women, each of the auxiliaries have a presidency, and then each of them have a board. And the presidency is responsible for a lot of training worldwide. So the presidency travels worldwide and just does training after training after training in many countries, in many languages. While the presidency is training, the board is doing a lot of the day-to-day work as they are looking toward the future. I didn't realize how far in advance the church has to plan. In fact, when I first got called to the board, people in my ward were saying, well, when do we get to see some of the lessons and some of the ideas that you come up with? And I'd just smile and say, well, stick around for about 20 years, and then maybe you'll see something. In reality, I was able to help participate with the new youth curriculum, and that didn't take that kind of time. But in most cases, the board is planning 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. And so the board is really thinking ahead and working with things that are kind of down in the distance. The board also is involved with some local training in local areas, and also giving support and counsel to the presidency. As the presidency bounces ideas off of the board, then the board is able to give feedback and support or suggestions. So we helped with some pilot programs and things that were going on. So it's a busy calling, but it's very much a behind-the-scenes calling. Last year was when the new Young Women Presidency was called. This is the first time that they have called a board that goes beyond the Wasatch Front. Because in the past, it's always been felt like the board had to be local so that they could meet and work together and they could interact. But the Young Women Presidency called members of their board who live in Japan, who live in South Africa, who live in Europe, and they're going to be having meetings via Skype. And so these board members won't be flying in for meetings, but they will be representing a more worldwide church. And I was thrilled to see that happen. And I think we probably will see a similar pattern as new boards are called down the road. Because we have the technology now that means that kind of board can still function and be effective, even though they're not sitting together in the same room.
Wow, interesting. That's one insight I wouldn't even have thought about, so I appreciate you sharing that. Now, when you're on a general board, is that your official church calling that your bishop's told, hey, you can't call Brother Wilcox to this, to anything while he's on the board?
Yes, because when you're on the board, it even though it doesn't involve many Sundays, it does involve a lot of work during the week. I don't think there was a week that went by that I wasn't in some sort of meetings, either with the board or in subcommittees, dealing with different issues where I was meeting with board members from some of the other auxiliaries. And so I was in meetings a lot and also doing a lot of groundwork, a lot of writing and a lot of interviewing of people, getting feedback, going out and doing focus groups, getting feedback from people, taking it back to the meetings. So it involved a lot of work. Again, not work that anybody sees, but work that's important, and it was very time-consuming. So that is your official church calling. When I did have on Sundays, my bishop asked me, not officially, but I helped sit in primary with a autistic boy that kind of had a hard time getting through the meeting.
Oh, wow.
And so on Sundays, I didn't, you know, it wasn't an official calling, but I would usually sit during primary and help this young man make it through his meetings and take him out if he got disruptive and things
cool.
like that. So I still attended my ward and I was still very involved in trying to help, but I didn't have a formal calling beyond the general level.
Okay. Cool. So this leads me to a question coming from the standpoint of a bishop, and I've had this question many times as a bishop, and I know other bishops have, is the role of the Sunday school presidency in a ward is sometimes very difficult to define. I know the handbook gives a descriptive role to that calling, and sometimes it sort of feels like it's the responsibility is more inflated than in reality it seems, and sometimes people joke like, oh, I've been called as the bell ringer, you know, during the second hour of Sunday school. What, from your perspective as from the Sunday school board, what tips would you give to a bishopric who's considering calling a new Sunday school presidency?
Yeah. If a presidency feels like they don't have anything to do, then they don't really understand the calling. Because someone who truly understands the calling is definitely going to have plenty to do. Sunday school is in charge of improving the learning and teaching in the entire ward, including in the home. Now, if any Sunday school president is out there thinking, God, what can I do in my calling? Man, what can you do to improve learning and teaching in the home? What can you do to improve learning and teaching in every auxiliary, not just Sunday school lessons, but with young men, young women, with the primary, with Relief Society, in priesthood? That Sunday school presidency is responsible for improving the level of education in the entire ward, along with serving on the ward council. Mm-hmm. So if somebody understands that, then he's going to stay pretty busy because he is going to have plenty on his plate, helping teachers understand their responsibilities, helping teachers be better. Think about how many classes you've gone to in church that could have been better than they were.
Yeah.
And think about how many family home evenings that are a complete flop. There's a lot of things that a Sunday school presidency could be doing to encourage parents and encourage teachers to make those experiences, times that we're already sitting through anyway, no additional meeting, but just taking advantage of the meeting time we have and really making it effective. Now, there's a lot of room for brainstorming there. There's a lot of room for personal inspiration. There's a lot of room for pulling teachers together for planning meetings. I know many wards right now are being very successful in having as they implement the youth curriculum, they're gathering. Those Sunday school presidencies are gathering the young men, young women, teachers, and leaders, and they're having a meeting during church time, right during the block. So while the youth are with Sunday school, they're gathering the youth leaders, and they're saying, what are we going to do for next month? Here's the theme. Here's the lesson outlines. How are we going to do this so that these can be as best they can be? And they're planning together. And then while the youth are in with the young men, young women, then they gather the youth Sunday school teachers, and they say, okay, what are we going to do so that the kids can be really engaged in what we're learning next month? And they're having these planning meetings once a month right during the block time so that it doesn't take anybody's extra time. They don't have to have an evening thing taking people away from families. But there's some Sunday school presidents who have really caught the vision of this, and they are involved, and they are hands-on, and they're running around so busy that their schedule is rivaling the bishop's schedule or the elders' quorum president's schedule or the Relief Society president's schedule. So, yeah, I think there's a lot more we could do to build a fire under some of those presidencies.
Okay. Well, that's all very helpful and insightful. I've got to put those down as line items that I can maybe visit with the Sunday school presidency. That's fantastic. So let's shift to your time as a mission president. As I interview different leaders, and I always ask them about their experience being called to whatever position they're in, because in the church we sort of have this unique approach to this idea of callings, and especially leadership callings. And maybe many leaders listening aren't familiar with the process that takes place from the standpoint of someone being called as a mission president. What was that experience like for you of being called as a mission president?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, it was something that I never really thought would happen because I'm not independently wealthy. And I had looked around and kind of seen that a lot of the men who were being called to this were men who had their incomes pretty well taken care of.
Yeah.
But now I realize that that's not necessarily a criteria, but it is helpful for some men because the church is concerned that they're asking for full-time service for 3 years, but then after those 3 years, you've got to go back and have an income.
Yeah.
So they can't really drop in and pull some guy out of his job for 3 years and then just turn him loose and have him be homeless and unemployed.
Yeah.
And so I think the church is wise to use men who do have some security, or to use men that are retired. In my case, I teach at BYU, and I think it was kind of easy for them to pull me and then put me back in because since BYU is church-owned, they could guarantee that I would still have a job when I come back.
Yeah.
So I don't think that that's the basis of any calling, but that was my misconception, is that I thought, that could never happen to me because I don't own my own company. I don't have all these millions in the bank. And so the one thing that surprised me was that really wasn't all that much of a consideration. the only question I was ever asked about income was if I was in debt. And when we were in our preliminary interview with Elder Eyring, who was a member of the 12 at the time, he said, you know, do you have any debt? I said, well, we've got the house and one car. And he said, could you rent the house and cover the mortgage? And I said, yes. And he said, could you sell the car? And I said, yes. And my wife said, no. She was sad because she finally had a car that worked. His only concern was that we weren't in debt, that we would be able to leave, and that we would be able to just live in the mission without any income to pay off loans. Because in the mission, you don't really have an income, but you don't really need one because you have a mission home, you drive a mission van, the mission puts gas in the van, they give you a small, very small living allowance to be able to buy some food and clothes for your kids, but you don't have a lot of expenses, and so there's not a need for an income. And so as long as Elder Eyring knew that I didn't have expenses beyond, you know, what we would just our living expense, our day-to-day living, then that was okay because they just, you know, I just couldn't have any debt. And so Elder Eyring did a preliminary interview in which they make it very clear that they're not calling you. They're just checking out your circumstance and finding out, you know, if your family is at such an age and stage that this is going to be not be a huge sacrifice. And so they ask a lot of questions, and Elder Eyring was wonderful to spend such time with us. We felt very privileged to have him privately for a long time and just have him showing such interest in us. And we were it was a very moving experience. And then they say, you know, if you're going to be called, the call will come from the First Presidency. And so later, when the call came from Elder Faust, then he's the one who extended a call. And he told us that it would be a Spanish-speaking mission, but didn't tell us where. And he was a lot more pressured for time than Elder Eyring had been, and a lot more down to business. The interview was much shorter, but it was kind of fun. I think you might remember when Elder Faust gave a talk in conference about the little engine who could.
Yeah.
And I think I can, you know. Well, it was so funny because it was right after that talk that I had this interview with him. And so when he asked me, do you think you could be a mission president in a Spanish-speaking mission, just the way he phrased the question, my answer was, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. And my wife kicked me under the desk because she thought I was getting a little feisty. But actually, Elder Faust laughed, so that made me happy. I got a laugh out of Elder Faust. But his interview was much shorter, but he extended the call. And then later we received in the mail an envelope, just like young missionaries or just like couple missionaries. We received an envelope that then called us to our specific mission in Chile. And so there was a time there in which we didn't know where we'd be serving. We knew we'd be serving, but we didn't know where. And so we were very excited when the call came, and I knew I was going back to the same country where I'd served as a young man.
Oh, cool. Now, serving as mission president, I'm sure there's a lot of experiences that come from that, specifically focused on leadership. The thing I find intriguing about the missionary program and having these various missions is they're each sort of a laboratory of leadership, where I remember as a young missionary, it was really my first taste of being a leader and having opportunity to be a leader. I remember a time as a young district leader and knowing that the zone leader was going home, and then they brought in somebody else to be the zone leader, and I was thinking, oh no, what's wrong with me? Did I do something wrong? You know, why wasn't I the zone leader? And you sort of get this taste of the addiction to leadership and, you know, seeking leadership to some extent, and then you soon realize that nobody nobody really cares when you get home.
that's the truth.
Right. So what was, and you mentioned this in your, I think it was chapter 9 in your the continuous conversion, kind of about this dynamic of pride and leadership and some of these experiences you had with missionaries and leadership. Is there anything that comes to mind that you could expound on about that experience?
Yeah, we had a very unique experience in that when I went down to the Santiago East Mission, I was the fifth mission president in less than a year.
Oh, wow.
The one brother's wife passed away. They sent him home. Another brother came. His wife got a brain tumor, and they sent them home. Then a Chilean brother was watching the mission, but then he got called as a mission president in Venezuela, and so he needed time to get his affairs in order. And so then a general authority was kind of overseeing the mission, which meant that he wasn't actually there. He was just kind of overseeing what the assistants were doing.
Wow.
And so when I finally showed up in that mission, I was the fifth mission president. And some of those missionaries didn't know, you know, which way was up. And it's not that they were all being rowdy or out of control. I think it's just that they didn't know, they weren't getting a clear direction as to which way they should be going. They all had good hearts. They all wanted to be diving in and doing what they should, but they just weren't clear exactly on what needed to be happening. And so I saw right there the power and the difference that a leader makes, because when these kids felt like they were without a leader, then it was difficult for them. The first time I did interviews with the missionaries, one missionary started to bawl, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, maybe he's got to confess a sin or something, and I was all worried. And come to find out, he just said, it's so nice to have an interview. He said, I haven't been interviewed in over a year. And, you know, when you've got a kid out there who's struggling along and learning a language and missing home and trying to get used to a new culture, he needs a leader there. He needs a dad there. He needs a mission president. And some of these mission presidents had been so caught up in the worries of the moment and just trying to keep all the balls in the air that you know, some of these good little missionaries that were just plodding along day to day weren't getting the attention and love and validation that they needed. So I definitely saw the difference a leader can make in helping people feel secure and in helping people feel motivated and in guiding them toward the goals. So it was a quite a abrupt start to a mission.
Wow.
But we also lived through the time of the raising of the bar. We served from 03 to 06. And so as the bar was raised and as the demographics of the church changed, we finally started hitting this point at which Mormon families just weren't as large, and Mormon families weren't producing 6, 7, 8 missionaries. They were producing 2. Well, then between the demographics and the raised bar, the numbers of missionaries dropped all over the world. Our mission went from about 220 down to about 110, 120. And so that started a little problem because, you know, we would send home 16 missionaries and we would get 3 missionaries. So all these elders were ready to be trainers, they were ready to be district leaders, they were ready to be zone leaders, and I had fewer and fewer needs for district leaders, zone leaders, trainers, and so it became a real issue, and the missionaries would get quite upset because they wanted these leadership opportunities, and yet there just weren't a lot there to have. Mm. And so, you know, some missionaries would feel bad because they couldn't write home and tell mom, hey, I'm a district leader, or hey, I'm a trainer. And so I really grappled with the whole idea. I thought, what do I do? Do I just call the whole mission as zone leaders and then just give them a zone of one person just so that they can write home and brag to their friends?
Yeah.
You know, do we sacrifice the quality of work in the mission for for the sake of self-esteem. And finally, I just thought, no, what these missionaries need to learn is just the lesson of the church. And that is that callings come by revelation, whether it's for the needs of the missionary or the needs of the mission. The callings come by revelation, and that ultimately it doesn't really matter where we're serving or what the title happens to be, mm-hmm. as much as it matters that we're engaged in the work. I told the missionaries, I said, it's not a ladder we're climbing, where if you're a good little zone leader, you get to be the assistant, and if you're a good little assistant, you get to be the elders' quorum president when you come home, and then you get to be bishop, and then you get to be, you know, it's not a ladder we're climbing.
Yeah.
I told them, take the ladder and set it down on the ground, and then the ladder doesn't become a ladder, it becomes a train track. And callings are just a way of kind of moving us around so that we're learning what it is that we need to be learning. When I was called as a mission president, my calling was the Weebelos leader. Well, a lot of people would say, wow, you really took a step up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but then when I was released as a mission president, my calling was an advisor in the priest quorum. Oh, then I took a step down. No, we got to stop thinking of it like steps up and down. We got to start thinking of it more like a train track that kind of moves us around and lets us serve in many different ways and many different capacities. In Chile, we would often have a big problem with former bishops and stake presidents leaving the church and going inactive because they got offended when they were released. And I thought, we've got to do this differently. We've got to teach this differently so that somebody doesn't feel like, oh, I'm being punished by being called to the nursery, which is my calling right now, by the way.
Oh, great.
I'm serving in the nursery. I want people to understand that the different callings are all part of helping us become more like Christ. Sometimes that means we're up in front at the pulpit, and sometimes that means we're wrestling an autistic kid in primary, and sometimes that means we're sitting and reading books to little kids in nursery. Whatever those different opportunities are, they're teaching us something, and that's important.
Perfect. And this leads kind of to my next question. I think back to a conference talk that President Uchtdorf gave in October of 2010 called Pride and the Priesthood. And he tells this funny story about a time he was out with President Faust and visiting different stakes. And he said, President Faust said to President Uchtdorf, they will treat you very kindly. They will say nice things to you about you. Dieter, be thankful for this, but don't you ever inhale it. And there is this kind of drug of leadership that is felt from time to time that when a transition happens in a calling, you have to come down off this high of being the person that everybody had a question for or the person that was able to provide something to the group, the ward, the quorum, whatever it is. So what thoughts do you have as far as transitioning out of leadership callings in the church?
You know, when I came home from my mission, it was very difficult for me to transition. I literally went through about 6 months where I was feeling a little lost. It wasn't because I didn't jump right into another calling, and it wasn't that I didn't love the priests I was working with, but I was having a hard time taking this full-time focus that I had as a mission president and then suddenly shifting gears back to juggling a lot of balls. The work ball, the church ball, the other balls, the consultant, the author, the speaker, you know, and suddenly it was just a little tricky because I'd had the privilege of being able to keep all my focus on one thing, and suddenly I was kind of taken away. And it was a while for me as I made that adjustment. So I think the first thing we've got to remember is just to be patient with others and to be patient with ourselves. Because it does take a little time when you're shifting gears from one calling to another. When you've been in a high visibility calling, it's a little tricky to kind of shift gears. I even felt it a little when they asked me to turn my parking pass in at the church office building after I was released from the board. I thought, dang it, that parking pass is gold. You know, I've had a place where I could park in downtown Salt Lake. Who gets that, you know? And suddenly that was gone. But I think we can just be patient with ourselves. And I think it's also a time to remember exactly what we're doing this for. Stephen Covey was a man I admired and respected so much, not just through his writings, but because I knew him and his family very personally. And I love Brother Covey. And one time he said to me, you know, if I start competing with those around me, then I look at them as, you know, the enemy. And he says, in my field where I'm going out and doing this professional consulting and speaking, it's high-powered, high-paid, high visibility. He says, it's very competitive. And he says, I get myself in trouble if I start saying, oh, he got the contract and I didn't. Oh, dang it, what does he have that I don't have? And he says, oh, he said it was very difficult for me. But he says, if I kept my eye on my mission, now that sounds like Stephen Covey.
Right.
He said, if I remembered my mission, I'm here to help make better leaders, to help make better companies, to help leaders be guided by principles. He says, then I would stop and I'd say, that guy's not competing against me. He's my friend. He's helping me because I can't be everywhere. And so he's helping me reach my goal. And so I think in the church, if we remember that the goal isn't to build Brad Wilcox, the goal is to build the kingdom. And if I can keep that in mind, then I'm not hoping the next president, the next mission president fails so that I look better. I'm not hoping that the next bishop makes a bunch of mistakes so that everybody comes to me and says, you were a better bishop than he was. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that they succeed because ultimately they are essential in me reaching my goal, which is to build the kingdom. You know, some people think that because John, by the way, and I do a lot of similar things, a lot of people think there's this big competition between us. And they'll come up to me and they'll say, I think you're better than John, by the way. Or worse, they'll come up to me and they'll say, you're not nearly as good as John, by the way.
Oh, no.
And they think there's some big competition between
yeah.
us. And they don't realize that John and I have been friends for years. We love each other, and we're on the same team.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they see it or not, we're on the same team. And whatever opportunities he has are blessing me, and whatever I'm doing is helping him because we have the same ultimate goal. People come up to me now, and because my name is Wilcox, they connect me with S. Michael Wilcox.
Yeah.
So they'll come up to me and they'll say, will you sign your book? And then they'll hand me one of S. Michael Wilcox's books. And I used to explain, but I don't even explain anymore. I just sign. I just sign. You know, it's funny because they'll come up to me and they'll say, your talk on such and such changed my life. And I think, well, S. Michael Wilcox is the one that gives that talk. But again, I don't explain.
Yeah.
Because it's not a competition. It's not a who's being quoted and who's not being quoted.
Right.
It's we have the same goal. We have the same end. And so S. Michael Wilcox is a dear friend. He's not a relative, as many people ask me, but he's a dear friend, a wonderful teacher, and I never feel like I'm in competition with him. I feel like we are companions, missionary companions. We're on the same team. We're moving in the same direction. And those are very sincere feelings for me.
Yeah. Well, that's sage advice. I appreciate you kind of expounding on that. That's very, very helpful. I want to shift gears a little bit onto the topic of grace and leadership. And you're, at least in my world, since I've read your books, you're sort of, and your talk that I recommend to many people coming to my bishop's office, so his grace is sufficient.
Glad that's been helpful.
Yes, it's fantastic. Do you feel like you're kind of looked at as the grace guy in LDS circles, or was that meant to
be? Well, if that's the case, I'll take the title.
Good, okay.
because there's just nothing that thrills me more than people starting to understand the power of grace in our lives. When I was serving as a bishop of a YSA ward, that's when I first started thinking about this, because kids would get so discouraged. They would come in and confess, they'd feel better, then they'd go up and they'd make a mistake again, and then they'd just collapse. They'd beat themselves up. They'd say, see, I can't do this. I can't repent. I can't change. And then pretty soon they're quitting the church. They're totally inactive. And you're like, whoa, how did we go from active to inactive and all over a matter of weeks just because they feel like, you know, they get themselves caught in these cycles. And instead of seeing the atonement and grace as being something that's helping them through this change process that takes time, they see repentance as a one-shot deal. Okay, now I'm clean, I've used the atonement, and now I'm sin-free, and now I just have to live in this bubble the rest of my life. And then when they find themselves soiled by sin again, then they just feel like, I can't do this. And so the kids say, I can't do this Mormon thing. I've heard that so many times.
Yeah.
I can't do this Mormon thing. Their expectations are too high. I just can't do it. And that's when I started thinking, we've got to teach about grace. We've got to teach about the Savior's atonement in a way that's hopeful. And we've got to take the focus off of just being able to repent and be forgiven. And we've got to shift the focus toward this transformation that happens as our hearts are purified and as we get to the point where we don't desire to sin again. It's not, will the Lord forgive me? Yes, he'll forgive us over and over and over again. But the goal, ultimate goal, isn't to be forgiven, to be cleansed so that we can enter heaven. The ultimate goal is to be changed, to be heavenly, not just qualified to go in because we're spotless, but ready to go in because we have developed Christ-like attributes and we have become more like him. And so that's when I first started thinking about all this. And as people have kind of picked up that stick and run with it, I've just been thrilled because I see that people are catching this vision that the atonement isn't just an eraser. It isn't just a piece of soap. It's also a change agent, and that through its power, we truly can be transformed.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that. It reminds me of a few years ago, I was reading the Continuous Atonement book, and it reminds me of a story that I think you'll find helpful to know that your words and research are making a difference. But I was still the bishop at that time, and there was a sister in my ward who had her 9-year-old was quickly taken away from her. He passed away in a tragic accident, and that night I went over there, and as you can imagine, what her state of mind was and emotion, and there was this moment where she looked at me and she said, "Bishop, why is the Lord punishing me?" And I stopped, and your words came from your book to my mind. I said, "Sister, you're not being punished. You're being sanctified." And I could, there's just this hope in her eyes of like, oh, like this isn't because something I did, or, you know, this doesn't have to do with me. It's more about what you're becoming. And so
see, we've got too many people in the church who feel like it's this big gumball machine,
yeah,
or this big vending machine. If I put in a full tithing and I live the word of wisdom and I do this and I do that, then I pull the little cord and boop, out pops all the blessings I want, and they're the blessings that I define, not the blessings that God sends,
right,
but the blessings I want. If I do this, this, and this, then poop, God's going to give me a husband. If I do this, this, and this, poop, God's going to make sure I never get cancer. And if I do this, this, and this, poop, all my children are going to stay strong in the church. And see, then when those things don't happen, then we feel ripped off. We feel like, see, yeah, look, I put my money in, and I pulled the chain, and this didn't happen. And that's when we've got to realize that it's not a vending machine. God's not up there just dispersing blessings to the worthy. He's up there trying to teach each of us in this mortal school how to become divine.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those that receive some of the hardest struggles are those who are most ready to learn. sometimes those struggles aren't a sign that God has abandoned us. Maybe it's a sign that God's taking us to that next level and that he's ready to teach us and that we're ready to learn at an entirely different level. That's the perspective that Elder Maxwell had, and that's certainly what he kept trying to teach as he dealt with his cancer.
Yeah. And that takes me on to kind of another dynamic that I see in the bishop's office is just a random example, you know, a newlywed couple that maybe is going through a divorce for one reason or another. And I remember talking with the husband and he's saying, you know, I don't get it. We read the scriptures every day. We've done family prayer. You know, I try to go to the temple. And I think it goes, and my question kind of hinges on this idea that's found in Doctrine and Covenants section 8210, where it says, I, the Lord, am bound when you do what I say, but when you do not what I say, you have no promise. And so we somehow get in our mind, like you said, the gumball machine, where we're trying to bind the Lord to give us specific blessings, and whether it's a temptation or a trial that we're trying to pray away, what would you say is, what's the difference between earning blessings and earning salvation?
Well, I think that idea of binding the Lord, we forget that we are already bound to the Lord. We're bound to him in covenant. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a matter of, well, if I'm going to make this deal with the Lord, and if I read my scriptures faithfully every day, then he will give me this. You know, missionaries get caught up in this. Oh, if I fast and pray every day, then he has to give me baptisms. And I keep thinking, no, we're not binding the Lord to anything. We're bound to him in covenant, and he is bound. When we do what he says, he is bound to honor that covenant and to love us and to teach us and to bless us, and he will bless us. But who are we to define what is or is not a blessing? Are we really in the position, with our limited perspective, to be able to say, this is a blessing, this isn't a blessing? I mean, I remember on my mission, I think I wrote about this in the Continuous Conversion, we met a lady who, with a Down syndrome child, who had been told her whole life that this was a punishment from God, that she had done something wrong, that obviously God was not pleased with her, to punish her in this way, and along come two little Mormon missionaries who say, this is an angel child. This is a blessing from God. What have you done right to deserve to raise a child like this? And she said, they were saying what I've always felt in my heart. But everybody around me and in my Catholic background was telling me the opposite. But she said, I knew that this child was a blessing. And now these missionaries were saying that. Well, she ended up joining the church, and I had the privilege of living with her. We lived in her house when she was a grandmother, and she would provide a little room for us to rent. But I lived with her, and I loved that little handicapped child, that little special needs child. And isn't it interesting that what one person calls a curse, another person calls a blessing?
Yeah.
So are we really the ones who can say, well, how come I didn't get a blessing when I paid a full tithing? How come I didn't get an envelope in the mail from an anonymous person who gave me $100? See, sometimes we think we define the blessings, and that's not true. God defines the covenant. God defines the terms of the covenant. We don't say, if I do this, you'll do that.
Yeah.
God's the one who says, if you do this, then I'll do this. And those blessings come in many forms. And we have to understand, just like the old country song says, sometimes God's greatest blessings are unanswered prayers.
Yeah.
Because if we really got everything we wanted, no one would die, no one would be sick, no one would struggle, no one would have financial problems, at least nobody we love. Because
right.
We're praying for them to all be blessed. And yet sometimes I think God sees blessings from a very different perspective. And maybe this struggle that this family's having, this struggle this couple's having, even this long-term struggle with temptation that this particular man or woman is having, sometimes those can be blessings, especially as they draw us closer to God and they put us in contact with this incredible power called grace. What does it say? I will show you your weaknesses, right in ether. And then I'll show you your weaknesses so that you're humble and so that you'll come to me. Because then, with me, we can be strong. And those weaknesses can be worked on and changed and over time polished. And we can be strong because you're not going to be doing it alone.
So true. It never gets old talking about the grace of Christ. Am I right?
Oh, never. In fact, you know, I think as I think about what bishops can do to truly connect people more with that, is maybe what we need to do is stop trying to solve problems. People come to us, I'm getting divorced. I'm having this temptation. I'm struggling with my finances. I'm struggling with a wayward child. And they come to us as if we're the fountain of all knowledge. And I think what we need to do is get out of the way and say, you go inquire of the Lord yourself. You go find out what he would have you do. And then I'll help hold you accountable for that. But I think so often we try to pass out solutions, and solutions that come sometimes in sounding very cliche and trite. Well, just read your scriptures, just say your prayers, just attend your meetings, just pay a full tithing, and everything will be fine. And I think instead of passing out solutions, we would be better off saying, what are you going to do about it? What would God have you do about it? Bishop, my wife wants to leave me. Well, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Well, that's why I came to you. No, as Elder Bednar would say, you need to be the one who acts. You don't come and wait to just be acted upon. You be the one who acts. You seek solutions. And then what we have in the church is a mechanism of accountability. See, when I can go confess to a Catholic priest and I never see him again, he doesn't even see me or know who I am. So I unload, but I never am held accountable for change. But the blessing we have is that we see priesthood leaders face to face, and that means we're accountable. So as we set goals and say, okay, this is what I'm going to try to do, then we have somebody to hold us accountable and say, how's it going? Not, what are you doing that I asked you to do, but what are you doing that you've come up with to solve this problem? And is it working? If it's working, great. If it's not working, let's adjust the goal. I've talked to many kids who struggle with pornography and masturbation, and I say, what are you going to do about it? And they say, I'll never do it again. And I say, bad plan. I say, if that plan worked, then you wouldn't be in this hole, because you've made that promise 50 million times and you've broken it 50 million times. Now give me something you're going to do that's doable. Well, sometimes that might be a goal that says I'm going to do it less than I'm doing it, or I'm going to not, I'm always going to be honest about when I do it, and I'm always going to tell you or tell my parents. See, those are goals that the kid can work toward and he can achieve. And then instead of always being failure after failure after failure, every time he comes to see me, we can start building on a series of successes. And he can say, I made my goal. Maybe the goal doesn't have anything to do with pornography. Maybe the goal is just reading scriptures every day. All right, there's our goal. We're not going to worry about the rest, just this. Well, then he can come and he can say, yeah, I still struggled, I still fell, but I read my scriptures every day. Well, then there's a success to celebrate. And then we can just start one more time. Okay, what's our next goal? What's our next goal? I think leaders in the church have to understand that worthiness is not flawlessness.
Yeah.
Worthiness is honesty. And if that kid is being honest with me, then we can set goals, and those goals can be achievable. Never again is not an achievable goal when you're in the middle of compulsive behavior. It's an ultimate goal, but it's not the first goal that we're going to go for. Instead, we're going to say, let's bite off this goal, let's bite off this goal, let's bite off this goal. And pretty soon, success after success after success, and pretty soon the kid's in a situation where it's much more realistic to say, I'm now at a point where I'm never going to do this again. And those, that step-by-step incremental worthiness, instead of all at once, once and for all, to be able to say to a young man, if you reach your goals, you're worthy to bless the sacrament. If you reach the goals we've set, you're worthy to home teach. Instead of saying, you're not worthy to do those things until you can show me that you're going, you know, you've gone 3 months, 6 months, 9 months without this behavior. See, then you're, the failure is reinforcing failure. And on, if we go the other direction, then we've got success reinforcing success, reinforcing success. And then we see kids who truly are reaching out and feeling that enabling power of Christ. And they're experiencing those changes that can happen over time, rather than just being discouraged because they don't see any progress.
Thank you so much. That's a great perspective. And I know we're short on time. I've just got a few more questions for you. Is it okay if I ask those?
Sure. Let's go for it.
Okay. And before I get into that, before we close, I just want to speak from being a bishop who was called without a clue of what he was doing, and I'm sure every other bishop would say that as well. I just want to thank you for the work that you've done in relation to the grace of Christ and putting it in a form that we can understand and then translate to the people who sincerely need the grace of Christ when they come into the office.
That means a lot to me, because that's why I try to do this, is just so that it can help someone, help a leader, help someone who's struggling. That's what I'm trying to do. And so if it's helped you and if it helps some others, then I just can't tell you how much that means.
Good. Well, I feel it's important that you really know that. In relation to these last final questions I have, I want to kind of tell a story, and I'm not trying to puff you up with pride too much. We'll see if we can find something to deflate you at the end of this. But I think there's an important.
What did Elder Uchtdorf say? Don't inhale.
Right. Yeah. Just don't inhale as I go through this. Okay. So my sister went to BYU and was an elementary education major, and that's the department that you teach in. And she had you as a teacher, and obviously she did. I don't know if this was the time when she was doing some student teaching down in Mapleton or her first job as a teacher, but she remembers a time that you came and did an assembly about being an author and writing.
Yeah.
If you remember those. And, you know, the kids benefited from it. She remembers one student in particular that just was just so motivated from that assembly to become an author. And so he went home and he wrote this book, and, you know, as good as fourth or fifth grade, I don't know what grade, you know, as good as an elementary school kid could write a book. And my sister let you know that this boy was excited about writing, and she remembers that you came back to the school, you took the child out of class, and you sat with him and read each page of that book with him. And he was so impressed that he was just on cloud nine, you know, after that experience. And the reason I bring this up is that this, and I kind of define it as Kimball kindness. And you reference a story about a kid who was named after Spencer W. Kimball in your book, and you told him to go read his biography, which I've done. And throughout the book, you're just like, it's amazing, this man who had such responsibility, but still found the one and served the one in the most simple ways. And so my question to you is, I've seen kind of various experiences I've heard about you, especially this experience with my sister doesn't talk about any other professor at BYU. I mean, obviously it had an impact on her heart as well. But how do we as leaders figure out how to do this type of Kimball kindness when we have so many obligations, so many things to sign, and it's hard to just stop and focus on the one for a minute? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think I'm with you. I think President Kimball was an incredible example of that. I think our current prophet, President Monson, is an incredible example of that. And And I think that's kind of, maybe it's those images in our minds that can give us the courage to do that. Because, you know, I was so flattered and honored when Elder Eyring asked to interview us. I was so flattered that he would take a substantial amount of time and not just treat us like the next customer at Baskin-Robbins, and that he would visit with us and get to know us and get to know our situation. I was so touched when Elder Faust took time to kind of laugh with me, and when he kind of let down his guard and let down his public face and just laughed and told some funny stories. I was so grateful for those moments with these leaders. And then you have to turn around and say, well, in the life of some of these kids, in the life of some of these ward members, we are the President Kimballs, we are the Elder Eyrings, we are the President Monsons, and we are the Elder Faust. Not that we have their authority or not that we have their position, but we have the same commitment. We have the same mission. And so just as Elder Faust and Elder Eyring's success helps build the kingdom, then my little successes, my little simple things I do, sitting down with a kid, paying some attention to him, giving him some encouragement, making him feel special, that helps. That helps. I think I was always so jealous in college because my friend, Stephen Cap Perry, was off with the Young Ambassadors, and they were touring China for the very first time. And here they were opening up China and giving China exposure to the church and to the school. And I was so jealous. I wanted to be over in China. I wanted to be helping with the work. I wanted to be a light to the world. And then I was there on campus, just stuck, going to classes. And I was in a line feeling bad because I wasn't in China. And all of a sudden, some girl behind me asked if I could help her. And in her broken English, she tells me, I just come from China, and I need help getting to this building. And I thought, well, I may not be a light to all of China, but I can be a light to this girl because here's one that Steve's missing. You know, Steve's over in China being a light to millions and millions of people, but here's a Chinese girl that's not in China. She's right here in line with me at BYU. That's what we do at BYU. We stand in line. And I thought, here she is, and I can be a light to her. So in my own personal mission statement, you won't find the phrase, I want to be a light to the world. You will find the phrase, I will be his light to my world. And that's what I want to be. And so whether it's pulling a kid aside at a school and giving him some encouragement on his writing, or whether it's talking one-on-one with kids when they come with issues and concerns, or whether it's writing, or whether it's speaking in a Sunday school class, or whether it's to a huge, large group, it doesn't matter to me, because I decided long ago that I'll let God decide how big my classroom is. I'll let him decide if my classroom grows, if it becomes a worldwide classroom. That's his choice. But I will continue to be a light to my world. I will continue to be a teacher in my classroom, however large that classroom is or is not. And that I'll leave to God. I'll let him worry about that. But in the meantime, I'll just keep trying to be a President Kimball. Maybe there's kids out there who never will know President Kimball, but they'll know me. And maybe through me, they can get a little glimpse of President Kimball. And maybe there's kids out there who never have a chance to meet President Monson, but they have a chance to meet me. And maybe through me, they can get a little glimpse of President Monson. And if I can provide that glimpse, maybe not the great leadership that these brethren provide, but if I can provide a glimpse of their leadership, in the lives of some of these young people that have that they might never meet, then I'm helping move the work forward. In my own little quiet, private, personal way, I'm helping to move the work forward.
Well, thank you, Brad. This has been a fantastic interview, and I'll cut it off there and put it together. I'm so excited to share it. I think it'll bless so many leaders that that are seeking this type of advice. So I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I'm going to read you one last thing.
Okay.
In the back of my calendar, I always have a little quote that comes from the biography of President David B. Haight. Elder Haight was just a real role model for me, a man that I met once while I was a young missionary, and ever since then I always felt such a love for him. And so in the back of my calendar, I have a quote that comes from his biography, and I read it during the sacrament sometimes. And I want to just end by reading that to you. It says, "There are so many hands to shake, so many smiles to smile, so many eyes to look into, so many hearts to touch, that I ask, how can I go faster and more effectively serve in the kingdom?" And I think that's the motto that Elder Haight lived by. It's the motto I try to live by. And I think it's a motto that every leader in the church needs to internalize and personalize. How can I go faster and more effectively serve in the kingdom?
This concludes the interview with Brother Brad Wilcox. I encourage you to go check out his books relating to the grace of Jesus Christ, namely The Continuous Atonement and The Continuous Conversion. And also check out his new book, The 7-Day Christian. Brother Wilcox was so kind enough to offer 3 of his books that we can give away to the listeners of the Leading LDS podcast. If you go to leadinglds.com and go to the post where this podcast is featured, you can do that by simply searching Brad Wilcox on the search bar at leadinglds.com. And on that post, it'll give you further information on how to enter to win one of the 3 books that Brother Wilcox has given us. There is a time limit on it. This podcast is being recorded in October of 2014. Be sure to check that soon, because obviously the contest does need to end at some point so we can give those away. Thank you for listening, and always remember and figure out ways to insert the grace of Jesus Christ in your leadership.